Welcome to the Orthodontics and Interview Podcast, where Farouk brings you closer to the experts in orthodontics so we can hear their story and learn from their experiences with your host, Farouk Ahmed.
Welcome to this episode of Orthodontics in Interview. Guys, it's a real pleasure of mine to bring you guys Audrey Yoon, who's coming all the way from the USA, from Los Angeles. Audrey, welcome to Orthodontics in Interview Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Guys, this podcast is set to really look at obstructive sleep apnea. Audrey Yoon is an expert, and I'm going to tell you why she's an expert in this field before we get into the questions and get into the crux of it. So Audrey Yoon is an adjunctive assistant professor at Stanford University. She's, I'm sure, on the way now to become a professor, but she's prolifically published within the field of sleep medicine. She's had 19 publications, I counted, over the last 5 years, both in Sleep Journal, both in Sleep and Breathing, Head and Neck. These are really big, high-impact journals. So credit to her and her academic work. She's a dual qualified clinician. So she's qualified both in pediatric dentistry as well as orthodontics from UCLA. She specializes in sleep medicine. She's also a program director for dental sleep medicine in the fellowship in the University of Pacific. She's also established, and she's been a pioneer in establishing the World Dental Facial Sleep Society, and she's the current serving president. She's a diplomat for the American Board of Dental Sleep Medicine and the ABO. So it's a pleasure to have you here, Audrey, and really part of what I wanted to have in our conversation, and I've been a keen fan of yours in both your presentations you've had at the AAO, you've also presented at the benefit meeting and so many other platforms, is to really get into this kind of unclear area of obstructive sleep apnea and to get the opinion from yourself and to also go to some of the controversy that we see about opinions relating to this topic. So before we kind of get into those bits, what led you to have an interest in airways as just a topic in itself?
Thank you for asking that question to open our conversation. I am very passionate about orthodontics and the wonderful way that we influence our patients' life with our treatment, just like you. Early on my orthodontic residency, I was fortunate to meet Dr. Harper and Dr. Peck. Both are like prominent figures in sleep apnea brain research at UCLA, which motivated me to do some master's degree on obstructive sleep apnea. And then I met my mentor, Dr. Christian Guinamino, the father of sleep apnea, and I started working with this amazing pioneering, like multidisciplinary team of physicians at Stanford over the past 10 years, who welcomed and appreciate my orthodontic perspective. They really nurtured me. And I've seen lots of patients struggling with the symptoms. When a little kid doesn't sleep, it's not just for children's problem. The issue affects his or her parents or other family member who also becomes sleep deprived. It becomes an entire family problem. And working with these great like frontline thinkers inspired me to think about novel treatment approach and open my eyes to this field that we don't get exposed to in detail during our orthodontic training. In terms of the maxillary expansion exposures, we all know and probably use maxillary expansion in our practice. You know, maxillary expansion is one of the orthodontic treatments that has shown to be effective for sleep apnea. I know there is no randomized control study yet, but did you know there are more than 32 articles showing that it is effective? And if we're just looking at expansion and breathing functions, there are over 11 systemic review and over 132 single study out there. And routinely, we've been using palate expander in only relatively narrow age range between 7 to 14 to 15 years old. But I see the same narrow hierarchy palate patient with the sleep apnea in the patient older than 15 years old or also less than 7 years old. And they all struggle with the sleep apnea. So I decided to help the patient who did not fit this dogmatic 7 to 14 years of age. So I started this journey by applying MARPI, to sleep apnea patient who is older than 14. And patients' feedback spoke about the result. The patients start telling me their symptoms improved. They don't need to use the CPAP anymore. And there was a rewarding discovery. But then I also learned the limitation of MARPI. It didn't work as well for older population, especially like a male. That led me to developing more reliable technique, which is a dome technique, which is the combination of MARPI with conservative sarpi surgery. That technique works much better for older adult population, like a typical OSD population, middle-aged man, and they show more reliable results. So now we are focusing on developing less invasive and a more individualized, like, customized approach. But at the same time, I also started thinking, how can we safely and effectively apply the expansion for younger children who is also suffering sleep apnea, those younger than 7 years old? That's ensured how I get into the field of expansion and AOA.
Okay. So, Audrey, just picking up on that process of the being a lack of trials which are randomized, which have explored this, we have a body who would say that, actually, unless there's a randomized controlled trial, we shouldn't consider changing our clinical practice. What would your thoughts be about people who take that opinion? Is there a randomized controlled trial coming? Is it not possible to do in this particular sector? Why is it we haven't got that far yet?
Especially the younger child for the randomized control study, especially in US, is very, very, very difficult to do, especially who has already medical diagnosis. But we are planning something similar, so hopefully it's coming. In my personal opinion is expander is not like magic pill that you just throw anybody and then see it works. We know that orthodontist has to have a specific phenotypes that work. And some like a phenotype with like a small mandible, depending on where is obstructions, expansion is only one area opening up the airway. And I don't think it's working that well. I will talk about a little bit more later, hopefully, but it's not like a magic pill or like compared to CPAP, or not as effective as a tonsillectomy. So it has to be only used for sudden phenotype patients, sudden specific patients. So if you just throw, like, depending how you design the randomized control study, but if you're just throwing there for who has a children has a sleep apnea and then just see your expansion doesn't work, maybe the patient is not meant to for the expansion. So I think it has to be really designed well. And then I think it's coming. I was talking to some other group that hopefully is a new design. And the new design, the randomized control study coming, so that it's like we get a little better understanding and then better indication for a specific group.
Excellent. Wonderful. And just picking up on, you mentioned about expansion as a method of aiding the airway for the appropriate patient. And I'll come on to asking what you think those ones are. But what other non-surgical options are there besides the maxillary expander? Is there something else that you'd also consider so we can understand as an audience as to what else is potentially a treatment modality for obstructive sleep apnea in orthodontics?
So when we're talking about the non-surgical orthodontics, we can divide into two categories, like a technique for adult and then technique for pediatric patients. And when we select the treatment also, we have to look at where is the location of AOA obstruction. So two most common location was the upper, like think about the nasal cavity, which is surrounded by bone structure. So if you control well, we get very meaningful expansion and we can get the stable result. Versus the lower, think about the pharyngeal airway, just made of muscle, it's a collapsible tube. For the nasal airway obstructions, we can use the palatal expander because the palate is the roof of your mouth, but also floor of your nose. So if we expand the palate, we can also open up the nasal airway. But for adults with a mature suture, non-surgical treatment is very limited. We can attempt to use MARPI, but often we need a surgical approach. For the low pharyngeal airway obstructions, we need to move the jaw forward to create more space in the airway. So we can use a removable oral appliance, which brings the mandible forward. for adult, but imagine we bring the lower jaw and tongue forward, we open up the airway behind the tongue, which stabilizes the pharyngeal airway. But it is important to realize that the removable appliance for adult only control the airway at nighttime. It's not like permanent, you know, changes. But in other word, and for the pediatric patients, we have a unique opportunity to influence the jaw growth more permanently. So the same rule apply. We can look at the obstruction site. But as orthodontists, we also recognize skeletal discrepancy to normalize the growth. So we can apply maxillary expansion to improve nasal breathing and create tongue space. But also we can advance the maxilla forward or bring the mandible forward to increase the palatal pharyngeal or glossal pharyngeal airway space, and we can get the little more permanent changes.
Okay, so just picking you up on that one. So we've got the different modalities of doing it. So bring the mandible forwards, but also you mentioned about the expansion of the maxilla and the maxilla coming forwards. You mentioned in your paper in Dental Sleep Practice about it being a time to approach pediatric obstructive sleep apnea from a phenotypic focus. So just putting that, just itemizing that, what are these facial phenotypic types that we are looking at to provide this treatment?
So the phenotyping on pediatric OSA patient is not just to limit the facial features. Of course, as orthodontists, we have an advantage of recognized orofacial structure and understanding of growth, which is a huge asset for treatment planning. But in general, when we say pediatric phenotyping, I clinically categorize like roughly phenotype 1 and type 2 for the pediatric OSA. Type 1 is typically like thin, very active child. Their sleep apnea is very mild, but very symptomatic. Usually they have a neurocognitive or behavioral issue. They're like jumping up and down to the roof. Versus the type 2 is typically like obese child with a large fat deposit on the airway, which usually they're very sleepy. Their OSA is usually severe, and they're very similar to adult OSA classical trait. So also there is a trait or a combination of this type can be a child with like long-standing mouth breathing from nasal allergy, and they develop the adenoid long faces. Also, there is a group of patients has a hypotonia or neuromuscular problem, and those patients, we need a different approach. So all these patients has a sleep disorder breathing, but you don't treat them all the same way. So the phenotype approach is considering all these clinical trait, as well as orthodontic, like orofacial structure, which may contribute specific obstruction site, is all necessary to optimize our patient's outcome.
Okay, great. So that's kind of the ones that we're looking at for the treatment. Now, I just wanted to pick up on something you mentioned about making permanent changes to the growth. I think this has become a contentious issue about what changes do we make. We've got kind of Kevin O'Brien, and sits on the systematic review by Batiste that he was part of, essentially showing for AP growth, we don't have any long-term recognized differences in a large systematic review that he does. And at the same time, I'm hearing from yourself that we are looking to make these permanent changes to resolve, or as a parameter, the obstructive sleep apnea. So how do you kind of bring those two ideas together about what growth changes are achieved, at least according to class 2 correction for systematic reviews, versus what you're describing in managing the OSA, but actually having more permanent changes?
Yeah, that's the area with so much potential here, but not many applications have developed yet. And yeah, in order to establish the solid protocol, we need a lot of help from like outstanding orthodontists like you or your listeners. But maybe I'll talk about like a few applications we can do, or I share with some exciting thing at Stanford. The Dr. Chu's team, they developed we call orthodontic plate protocol for newborn baby with a pure Robin sequence. So the orthodontic airway plate is a customized, like a non-surgical removable appliance It looks like a complete dentures or obturator because 80% of them has a cleft palate as well. And they have extension into the throat. So the tail extension keep the baby tongue from the falling backward and then obstructing the airway. And when we use this orthodontic plate for newborn baby for 6 to 8 months, that stimulate the lower jaw growth, and we call the catch up the growth. And we see actually their mandible growth growth actually catch up their trajectory of their normal growth. And so this pure Robin sequence baby don't need a distraction or stereogenesis surgery. And this is quite striking. And I see there is a lot of potential there. We can grow the mandible if you we can intervene the right time. But, you know, in reality later, yes, we as orthodontists, we all talk about you can grow the mandible or not. To me, the actual length is not that important. I think how we grow the mandible is more important. If you are a vertical grower, and if you're growing more vertically, even though you grow the mandible 10 millimeter, it's not going to help for the airway. So I think another focus I personally working on is controlling the vertical. I use a lot of mini screw to control the vertical for those like a vertical grower. So if the growth pattern is a vertical, it's not favorable for the airways. I like to intrude the molar, rotate the mandible counterclockwise, so that we can actually change the growth in different directions. But I have to be very careful. And also key here is working with ENT and allergist and myofunctional therapist to ensure that patient can breathe through the nose. Because we cannot accomplish the nasal breathing, you know, ourselves most of time for long term. So that is the key here. But there is so much potential here. Just not many applications are developed. So I exert all of you to open your heart and mind. You guys are amazing techniques and clinical experience that we can accomplish to benefit our patients.
So I hear what you're saying. So essentially the types of changes that you're looking to achieve haven't really been studied to the same degree. And perhaps what we're looking at so far in the literature is a appliance or approach. Yet what you're looking for is something different, and that's what you're clinically instigating. So those perhaps the research previous doesn't actually relate to perhaps what you're doing at this stage. On the topic of Kevin O'Brien, Audrey, Kevin O'Brien has had some critical comments about obstructive sleep apnea in his blog. He wrote a bit about your lecture also at the AAO. And really, I wanted to know what your thoughts are around some of the academic criticisms that have come about from Kevin O'Brien and some others, and as to why that is the case at this point in our understanding.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to clarify a few misconceptions. These comments are unfortunate because this can be misleading. I think the important key here is that a clinician needs to work with a multidisciplinary team. Sleep is a multifactorial problem, and one clinician cannot fix it all. And orthodontic intervention are not the first line treatment for airway, and most likely never be. And I do not claim that orthodontic treatment is curing airway problem. However, as a clinician, we can potentially make a positive difference in our patients and their families' life. Regarding maxillary expansion in the preschool young age group, I'm not saying that we need to expand every young child. That is an unfortunate interpretation of my comment on OSA. However, if a child is suffering from medical condition and there is obvious craniofacial deficiency contributing to it, we need to consider to intervene regardless of the age to improve the symptom. And it is well established that neurocognitive and behavioral development are crucial at the younger age, before age of 7. For some children, it could be significant potential window for meaningful interventions. You know, as we all know, the sleep medicine itself is a very relatively young medical subspecialty. It has been one of the fastest growing medical field in recent years, though. So medical community as well as the public are now more aware of significant role of sleep in patients' general health. They will come to you to ask for treatment. So like some industry-driven appliance that Kevin O'Brien mentioned, you know, could be seen as a fad, but however, the application of medical concept related to sleep will continue to advance our field of knowledge. So I appreciate Dr. Kevin O'Brien's concern, but however, the tone of his commentary was the most unfortunate. We can all agree to disagree without being disagreeable. But by the way, I received a 98.8% positive feedback from the 339 attendees who listened to my AAO lectures. Only less than 1.2% didn't like it.
Okay, fine. We're winning that competition. Excellent. That's really good to help you that you've clarified what it is. And just so I can be explicit in my understanding, Audrey, if a patient does not have a deficient maxillary transverse relationship, if a patient does not have a deficient AP relationship, the application of these appliances is not to take, and they have obstructive sleep apnea. There is no role for these appliances for those patients. Is that my understanding? Perfect.
Correct.
It's really good to have cleared that up. And Audrey, on the topic of your lectures, you gave a lecture last year on the complications of MARP, which was phenomenal. And you followed it up with a publication, the AGODO Clinical Companion. And I do recommend anybody interested in this topic just reads this paper. It's a real clinician's paper about having carried out multiple treatments and just watched what happened with this relatively new type of appliance. Now, in that study, you highlighted a number of complications that are taking place, both from conventional fractures taking place asymmetrically, CANS, but also tinnitus, hearing loss, other bits taking place. Now, reading that, has that made you now carry out MARP less in that age group? Are you working more towards DOME, as you described it, for these patients? Or do you now still carry out MARP, but you're now just more informed in the clinical practice, considering the depth of some of those complications that can take place?
I mean, not at all. Not at all. The reason to publish our complication of MARP was not meant to discourage the usage of MARP. I mean, I teach MARP to our orthodontic resident. I run a MARP hands-on course. I encourage usage of MARP. So I felt it is also important to share my experience of complication as well, so many doctors can use safely. And it is important to have a realistic expectations and know how to troubleshoot if undesired results happen. And I wish more people are showing their complication. That's how we all learn so much more from the cases rather than the perfect cases. But once I was open about my failures, I was known to be a complication queen, and many colleagues approached me when it happened to them. So now our protocol has been improved. We are higher success rate and less complications. And this learning curve helped us to develop our field and needs to be shared. And at the end, I think now the MARP, the success rate is actually higher, so I tend to use the DOME a little bit less, if you ask to it, what happening.
That's really interesting that you were honest enough to look back, see the complications, and it could have reduced your carrying out the appliance, but you're able to, with that data, modify your practice and actually improve it, which ultimately is how kind of clinicians can improve by just self-reflection and working their processes, which is great. On the topic of looking at MARP or looking at expansion as part of management of obstructive sleep apnea, you've also described in your paper the roadmap to craniofacial growth about how prevention of sleep disordered breathing through orthodontic treatment should be considered. Now, that was a statement of prevention. In a letter that was a response set by Dr. Nicky Stanford based in the UK, he described actually that there was no evidence to support prevention for sleep disordered breathing using orthodontic appliances. So what were your thoughts on Nicky's comments in relation to it? Can you clarify as to where we stand with prevention for obstructive sleep apnea with orthodontic appliances?
Yeah, I talk about maybe 2 points. One about the prevention part. Prevention is a big word, I know. So we have to use very carefully. The application we discussed in our paper are for the children with a sleep disorder breathing. Again, we are not proposing every single child need early expansions or early interventions. But sleep disorder breathing is considered as a chronic, continuous and progressive condition. And it is well established in the literature that the inability to breathe through the nose can alter the facial growth. So something we can do reasonably diminish the progression could be considered. And definitely there is a potential to decrease the impact of OSA in adult by addressing the underlying pathophysiology in children. So yes, we need an extensive longitudinal study to ultimately understand how and when to best intervene. And that's how the paper is about. I think there is a lot of misinterpretation of this paper. In terms of the Nikki Stanford case, our reply to Nikki Stanford was officially published. So I would encourage your listener to read for themselves. I think his question was about the peer review process, but of course, the peer review process that required to publish in the top journal Sleep was extraordinary. I'm actually personally so thankful for the quality of the feedback the reviewer provided during the peer review process of this paper. The reviewers clinically gave deep thought to our submission. And from the orthodontic terminology and language use, I'm positive that the reviewer must be leaders in the orthodontic field. Their comment, suggestion really improved the paper and made my manuscript stronger. So I'm very appreciative. Personally, this is a very special perspective paper to me because my dear mentor, Dr. Christian Ginamino, who always told me, Audrey, you need to start some backbone or roadmap of growth modification guideline so that people can test it themselves and develop from there to move the field. And I always felt like there was a homework assigned to me. And after Dr. CG passed away, I mean, it took 9 years for me to publish that homework that somewhat is reasonable and safe. And I'm very grateful to publish in our target journal, Sleep. The journal Sleep is the very first sleep journal, which CG was the founding editor. Our co-author, Dr. Pelayo, even saved the CG personal copy of the first issue, Sleep, and display on his office on the wall. It's very symbolic to publish my paper inspired by him in his journal. And our publication discussed our understanding and future direction of potential interaction between craniofacial and breathing. We published a perspective, not the clinical practice standard, to share the idea that what is or may be working for our patient. And we also propose one of the main purpose of this article is propose a future research direction to answer this key questions. And definitely we need to have a longitudinal or long-term study. So I recommend our orthodontist colleague to try their own population, share their feedback so that we can modify and improve it.
Excellent. Excellent. Wonderful. I mean, that's a very well-weighted answer if I ever heard one to criticism. And it's great that you welcome it, Audrey. It's great because it can be an issue where there's recall and then there's so forth, but you seem to welcome the feedback and you seem to be growing as a consequence. So, Audrey, I wanted to get to the white paper that was published by the AAO in 2019, which looked at sleep disorder breathing. I looked at orthodontics in its role in that process. And I just wanted to get some statements in there that I wanted to get your thoughts on as to where you stood. One of those relates to RME expansion and how it can decrease the AHI. So that's the apnea hypopnea index, essentially reducing the episodes of obstructive sleep apnea. And that evidence they stated was short-term and long-term it can take place. But it also stated in the white paper that there's been no untreated control groups to compare this to. And that was phrased in a method, that's phrased in a way where it can be seen that actually the evidence is weak. It may or may not be true. What were your thoughts about this statement in the white paper? Do you think we've gone further than that? Do you think actually it always works well for AHI reduction? And where we should, how we should interpret that information?
I think the white paper is a very good publication, which summarizes the evidence really well. And I think AAO white paper support what I'm doing. I think the same statement, and you take it different way. Like, for example, you said RME and mandibular advancement should be primarily for skeletal management in pediatric patient, not primary method of managing OSA, but also AAA white paper also saying that there is a secondary effect. They actually mentioned that they agree the secondary positive effect of OSA of this treatment. And actually read the white paper even deeper, they actually even consider treatment without skeletal issues, case by case, with a multidisciplinary team. So they actually still give you the opportunity. And I mean, if you think backward, if you, the patient have OSA, but if there is no mandibular advance, mandibular deficiency, you will not use mandibular advancement. So we use this technique when their patient has a skeletal deficiency. So I think that is actually still enhanced the treatment modality that we are doing. In terms of the Dr. Pirale paper, this is actually the first paper that they actually have a long term, like they follow up for 12 years. And this is the first longitudinal study. Yes, there is no control group. So I agree that the statement that there is no control group, but it's amazing that it actually lasts long term because, again, it's a sleep apnea, it's a progressive disease. So we assume that it can actually get worse over the time. In terms of AHI, though, is the AHI, I don't take the AHI as like a Bible number. It's like a orthodontics, like SNA, SNB, or AMB, it's important when we're treating the patient, but we don't just go by the numbers because of some of the phenotypes and some of the symptoms, actually, the more it's important to address. And then even those Cone-beam CT should not be used for functional or diagnosis. But however, the Cone-beam CT has been very useful in terms of diagnostic of hard tissue and soft tissue and just looking at where is obstructions. It's not good enough for neuromuscular turn. It doesn't show you the collapsibility or functions. And however, it actually gave us a lot of information. So I think, I mean, I totally agree with the white papers. And that was published in 2019. The past 4 years, actually, we have a lot of new paper published, and we have gained greater experience to help the answer for those new questions. So hopefully, the future is exciting, and hopefully the good news is that this technique in the white paper may be more applicable for a wider range of patients, not just for the ages, but also clinical condition. And hopefully, it's, I believe the future is exciting, and I agree with the AAO white paper.
Excellent. It sounds to me, Audrey, that the comments that have been made in the AO, although it's only been 4 years, perhaps it's worthwhile considering it to be updated with the evidence that's come about over the past few years. Audrey, that's been a wonderful run-through of this process of OSA. I think you've clarified to me as to where you stand, but also where the science of sleep medicine stands in its interaction with orthodontics. You've been through a journey in this process, both pediatric trained and orthodontically trained. You've had sleep physicians that you've interacted with and work with. And I really wanted to know, kind of in your journey that's taking you to this point, who is it that you've admired the most in your journey?
Actually, Dr. Paola Pirelli, who is a kind of godmother in the sleep field, she was actually also the person who motivated me, because she's the one who the first paper in sleep that expanded their works. Yes, so we still criticize there's no control group, but she told me that how hard to publish that paper. She has to go to a lot of those sleep meeting often, that she's the only woman, she's only orthodontist, she's only dentist, and explain that some orthodontic treatment can be helping for the medical condition. And it took a while for her to publish their papers in 2004. And that really motivated me to actually go through all this. My personal little mentor right now is my chair at the UOP, Dr. Hisu Oh, and then also the Dr. Carlos Muir. They are really like with a nice heart, and they really encourage that all the my journey. So I hope that I can go through this, and hopefully in 20 years, I strongly feel very positive that our field is in the next level. We are not just to looking at the teeth and mechanics. We can be a true medical provider to really help our patients' health.
So just to round off the interview, the final question, Audrey, is that what one piece of advice would you give to the orthodontists who are listening to this podcast?
The first, thank you all of you out there for listening to this podcast all the way to here. I usually cannot finish most of the podcast. I really like to thank Farouk for providing such a wonderful, professional, welcoming, and comfortable forum to have this important conversation safely on how best to help our challenging patient. Orthodontics is such a beautiful profession. I believe it's so important for us to treat each other with respect and maintain our professional dignity so they never lose sight of important roles we play in our patient's life. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Audrey, for joining me for this interview. It's been enlightening having you on, and I look forward to seeing you in person, Audrey. Thank you so much.